Okay, so we coming to the last part of the today's class. We're gonna continue a little bit on the right view, or at least I'm gonna tell a little bit, and then we're gonna go to continue from there. Let's see where we end up today. Ajahn Pramali was saying that we are way behind, so I don't think we're that way behind, but we'll see. Right, okay, so what I wanted to talk about next was a little bit of obstacles to right view. So the right view is not corrected all at once. We've heard that many times today. And but at the end, there is maybe a breakthrough at the end. But until then, we're just sort of getting strengthened slowly, slowly. And there's obstacles on the way on to the right view. And so I found certain things from the suttas. Mendicants. I'm not really sure I like mendicants. Monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen. There are these four distortions of perception. Sometimes distortions translated as perversions, which I wasn't a big fan of that. I like distortions. This is a hybrid mudito Pramali translation with Pandasuchato.
Hybrid, okay, so three people.
Three people. So there are distortions of your perception. There's and the perception is sanya, so vipalasa is the distortion. It's distort your view, perception. And there's a distortion of mind, citta vipalaso, and ditti vipalaso, which is the view. Mind could be also translated as thought, and Ajahn Brahm sometimes translated as thinking, thought. And what are these distortions? You take impermanence to be permanent. We've been talking about what's a right view. You don't take things as a, there's a permanent essence on anything. Taking suffering as a happiness. Dukkang as sukkang. Taking not self as self. You're taking, these are the normal things we've been talking about many times today, today and previous, what, these are the right views, the normal three right views. And the fourth one, which is quite interesting, comes as taking ugliness as beauty. So you see beauty in where you shouldn't see that as beauty. And these are the obstacles, one of the four obstacles, where we can look why our view is not right yet. So these are the four things usually mentioned. One thing about this is that, which means that then, because of this and other things as well, but there is no really pure so-called raw perception. Sometimes it's mentioned in other traditions and even in Theravada tradition, sometimes some monks say that there is sort of like a raw perception. And that's not a right view.
What does it mean? What do you mean by raw perception compared to what?
So you... what do they mean? You always ask these tricky questions, will you?
I'm trying to draw things out.
Oh, right. Well, the thing is, until you get to the to be a stream winner, until that point, there is no really. You don't see the reality as it is, and that's what I meant here. I'm not sure what sometimes even famous monks like Bhikkhu Bodhi says by raw perception. What do you think? You have a right to answer properly again?
Well, it's, you know. so, of course I have the right answer. But I think this question arises in the context of things like the Mandupindika Sutta, right. The Honorable Sutta,
refine it.
18, where it says that depending on eye and form, the arising of consciousness, you get the eye consciousness depending on the three coming together, it's contact that gives rise to feeling, gives rise to perception. And then it says, based on that perception, there is thought, and then you have papancha derived from that. Yeah, right. So papancha. So there it says perception arises before papancha comes. Papancha is the proliferation of things.
Right.
So the argument is then what that first perception, that would then be considered raw perception, the kind of the initial one, before the mind has worked and distorted it, depending on its views and all these kind of things. So is that first perception, is that a raw and pure one before papancha works on it? That is the kind of question we're talking about.
That's true.
So is it such a pure perception? And probably not. Because that perception also is influenced by your vipalasas, by your distortions of things.
Right.
And that is really, I think, the point with that kind of issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. We talked about it earlier, and but you're always better explaining than I did. I actually did try to figure this out myself as well while I was doing these slides. And these are talked about maybe later Theravada Buddhist circles a bit more about that. And they sort of speculate about this. Whether can you just perceive and that in a certain way without having that, like Ajahn was saying, these vipalasas, these distortions before they enter there, is that a raw perception? Does it exist? But the perception itself doesn't mean anything. You have to have the idea about it. Maybe. I don't know.
I think I discussed it with Ajahn Brahm, and I don't think there is such a thing as a pure perception until you change your views and your whole outlook changes. But
okay. But one of the things actually Ajahn Brahm, we were talking about it in the car, and he mentioned this, that sometimes this is mentioned, and he mentioned this is one of the obstacles. So your thoughts obscure your worldview. And this is on the previous slide, that's the Chitta Vipalasa, what Ajahn Brahm sometimes translates as, instead of mind, he translates sometimes as thoughts. Mm. Right. You can only have pure perception after jhana. So I asked Ajahn Brahm, can you really trust your perception? And he said, you can trust it after the jhana, and because the hindrances are gone, I'm not sure, hopefully you haven't removed all of my slides, but there is certain hindrances which are come from while you're living in everyday life and when you haven't get into the deep meditation. But when you have really into the deep meditation, you can actually trust your perception. Then it's straightened for a while. But even then, you can get back into the ordinary worldly way of thinking. And maybe in here I could mention that if you translate the citta vipalasa, what we talked about on the previous, the distortion of the view, the mind, if you're thinking about it as a thought, thinking, that's the why, let's say, we have degrees of when people get enlightened, you don't get all the way to the arhantship. There is a certain way your thinking continues in a certain way. It's almost like you have, your thinking is not purified yet completely. People sometimes, they wonder, why isn't stream winner, why aren't they completely straight? What's missing in their thinking? And their thinking is not purified completely yet. There is this like remnants of wrong thoughts. And this comes from Bhikkhu Bodhi's writings more, where Ajahn Brahm got these ideas early on.
No, this is in the suttas.
It is suttas, he mentioned Bhikkhu Bodhi, but he put it nicely together. But so that's the, if you think about the citta as a mind, as thinking, thoughts are still, there is still not completely straight. So I just find this interesting slide. I mean, not really anything to do with exactly what comes from the sutras, but I just thought it was interesting these days what happens. We have this virtual reality we live in. Everything these days, you have everything in your phone. Everybody's carrying their phone with them all the time. But we have probably 7,000 people watched the first Eightfold Path in the, what we did, the first course. And we live in this virtual reality, and is this virtual reality, can you live with that as what the Buddha taught? Can we get the teachings from there? Can you be mindful? Can you have the straight view when you live with your phone all the time? You're in that reality. I just thought it's, when I saw this picture, I was looking for something else, but that just came up when, and the, what the moon is red? What about it?
What is it? What does it symbolize?
I don't know. You can say anything about it.
How do you interpret it?
The red moon behind it.
Is it the moon? Yeah, I guess it is.
Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah. But quite often we see it's almost like your view is these days. You look at everything through these classes of virtual reality these days. And we are moving faster and faster speed towards that. I find it interesting. What's going to happen when we more and more move into the world of virtual reality? I find it quite fascinating. I like to keep up with a little bit of what's happening with the how people are doing. I can see now they're doing already the virtual goggle conferences, and I could see maybe, you know, 10 years time, Ajahn Bhramali and I will be doing virtual reality, some other classes. I can see that that's happening more and more. Is it going to be an obstacle for us or not? I'm not sure, but I just find it interesting and sort of just thinking about it a little bit. Mm.
And doesn't look particularly good to me. Look at that red thing.
See, the path goes into your...
Yeah, but does it end up over there? That's my concern.
No, it goes into your mobile phone. Look how you're missing the beautiful moon behind it, and you're just staring in your screen.
Is it?
Okay, move on.
It looks kind of scary.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. But yeah. I just thought it was a little bit...
I wouldn't want to go there.
Okay, so obstacle. These are my slides, but because I was talking with Ajahn Bhramali, I'm trying to get my head around it. There's this different, always different Pali terms, and that's why I live with Ajahn Brahman and Ajahn Bhramali. They're always very helpful explaining to me these different kind of Pali terms, and there's going to be like three Pali terms now coming, and Ajahn Bhramali is going to then explain them.
What?
These are my slides, but I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more.
I'm your slave, is that right?
Yes, that's it.
Okay.
So we have, mm-hmm. So first one is Nivarana, an obstacle, hindrance, which are sensuality, ill will, tiredness and dullness, restlessness and worry, and doubt. Sometimes these are, these are considered as the five hindrances. Hang on. One, two, three, four. But there's more.
Tiredness and dullness is one, right?
Oh, okay, that's how it works. One. Yes, yes. Yeah. Restlessness and awareness. Yeah. So why are these hindrances to our right view, Ajahn Bhramali?
I'm really interested in this, actually. Would you like to explain this? No.
You told me so many times, but I still don't understand. Only thing I understand, these are just basic hindrances to your meditation. And if you don't have the meditation right, you don't get into the right view. But you probably have way better explanation.
Yeah, I don't.
You know, okay.
The sound of my own voice gets boring after a while.
Anyways, so it's one of those. I have three words here which I thought were interesting. So it was the previous from the previous slide. So there was there was something behind actually there. So we have these four, the vipalasas. Then we have nivarana, obstacle again. Then we have upakilesa. Another obstruction. So these keep adding on to our way to the path. So these are the kilesas, which sometimes are mentioned. Actual Pali word is upakilesa, but quite often it's mentioned in Thai tradition, they just say kilesas. So these are the minor spoils and obstructions, impurities and defilements into which are all the time in your mind. Then we have asavas. These are the in and outflows, which are the root of defilements, which are the karma, bhava, avijja. So the karma, what did you translate the karma? The worldly...
Worldly pleasures.
Worldly pleasures, bhava asava, to just have this asava, the outflow of the existence, and avijja, you didn't like ignorance, you like, this would be ignorance.
Yeah, ignorance, delusion.
Yeah. So this is the ignorance which obstructs you. These are the fundamental obstacles to realization of the truth. So there's all these things on the way, and I can't get my head around it. Could you please summarize, Ajahn Pramali? You're so nivarnas, asavas.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Am I going back? Kilesas.
Okay. The thing is that these are just different angles on the same problem.
Right.
And you look at some of those things, and it's the same defilements going again and again and again through here.
Yeah.
So you have the kama chanda, which is the first nivarana.
Nivaranas. Okay, so yeah.
Kama chanda. So...
Sorry.
Go forward.
Forward also.
Yeah. More. Yeah. So kama chanda.
Mm.
Sensuality. And so that is basically desire for worldly things, for the objects of the senses, anything to do with the objects of the senses, which is pretty much everything we know in that world. And then on the asavas, which come afterwards, you have the calm asava, which is the outflow. Here we can call asava an outflowing, the idea of flowing, whether it's in or out, but usually Ajahn Brahm would consider it an outflowing, and I think that there is some textual evidence for that. It's because your mind goes out into the world, because the five objects, the five senses, always seem to be outside. So it's kind of a moving outwards of the mind into the world. Yeah. So it gives a different angle on the same basic idea of the defilement related to the world outside. One is the mind flows out. The other one, it is that it is an obstacle. Yes, yeah? So it's a different angle on the same problem. It obstructs you. Why does it obstruct? Well, because as long as the mind is interested in external things, it is impossible to come inside and to let go of that. The interest in external things is going to be an attachment that stops you from going inside and becoming fully peaceful. You can't let go. As long as you have an interest outside, you can't let go fully. That's why these things are hindrances.
Right. And then in the Nivarana sense, in this sense, then you're taking ugliness and beauty as vipalasa.
Yeah.
Why do you call it then vipalasa?
Because it's the idea of seeing, you're not seeing the world as it actually is. You are seeing things in that world which you take to be attractive. But you forget about the impermanence. You forget about how quickly it changes. One day it's suddenly gone. And this is precisely the problem. This is why when we start with right view, you contemplate death, you contemplate old age, you contemplate how you can't have things the way you want them. Because after a while it sinks in that this really is out of control. And then you stop seeing beauty in those things that are out of control because you know you can't have them the way you want them anyway. Actually, not that beautiful at all. The beautiful aspect is only a superficial aspect. The full reality of the thing is very different. It's not necessarily ugly, but it's just lacking in that beauty that you take it to be.
Right. And that's why it's so interesting to look. I mean, sometimes you just get stuck in this translation. You see these, like, what does that mean? There's this word and there's that thing. And, you know, what does it mean to be fully enlightened? Does he have any of these things? And maybe if you stream enter, you still have a certain obstacle in there. Your thoughts are not purified yet completely. You maybe see permanence somewhere where you haven't actually completely purified your thinking. And I just find this fascinating. All of these other ones you mentioned, but what about the upakilesas? Then you see the minor stain.
Yeah.
What would be the minor stain, or let's say the sensuality then?
Well, upakilesas are, it's very similar to the five hindrances, the obstacles we saw before, except that there it is often classified into all kind of minor things like conceit and fear, and it adds all these other problems that we can have in meditation. Yeah. Five hindrances are just a kind of a summarization of all the possible defilements, yeah? But those defilements can then be subdivided into many, many more than the five hindrances. Yeah, and that is really the point there. So upakilesa is often a vast number of hindrances. If you read the Upakilesa Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 128, you see all the various kind of defilements mentioned there. Yeah, mm. Fear, excitement. Attachments, all kind of stuff you have find in there.
Right.
Yeah.
So all of these things are sort of obstacles on your way to the right view. And like I said earlier, these are only purified. You're on a path. You're really walking the Eightfold Path, meaning you're stream winner. Or after jhana, you can trust your views. All of these things I've suppressed for a while. But you're not there yet. So I just thought that was quite interesting way to look at the view. What are obstacles to the right view? And one is right view. So it gives you like a little perspective. And I mean, I was interested on the words as well. I think it might be, is it you? Rising? I can't remember now what's happened.
Have a look next one.
Let's see.
Yeah, my turn.
Yep.
Okay, so we're going to look at the conditions for the arising of right view. This was what Prem asked about earlier on. How does right view come about? How can you get right view from wrong view? How does wrong view give rise to right view? So you need something there to kind of cut, to break the circuit, because delusion tends to be self-perpetuating. Delusion usually creates more delusion. So how do you cut that almost like circular thing where delusion just keeps on perpetuating itself? And this is, again, everything here is probably from the suttas, pretty much, not everything, but most of it. So what are these? So the Buddha says this is actually Venerable Sariputta, I think. There are two conditions for the arising of right view. Yeah, so this is now, it gives you an idea what it is that you have to do to give rise to right view. The words of another, paratogosa, is the first one. Yeah, and this is why we have the Buddhist teachings. That's why we have the Buddha. That's why the Buddha matters so much. That is why the noble ones in the world matter so much, because these are the ones that have access to the insight of reality. Yeah, so the words of another gets you going. This is one way of giving rise to that right view. You listen to someone and think, yeah, there's something to what you say. You're making a good point. Maybe I should think like that. Or alternatively, or maybe in addition, if you like, wise attention, yoniso manasikara. So it means that you are looking at things in the right way, you are attending to things in the right way, yeah? You are turning your mind towards something, and you have the right attitude when you turn your mind towards something. Yeah? So these are the two things. Let us look at these things in a little bit more detail to see what this really actually means. So first of all, the idea of good friendship, yeah, the voice of another or the words of another, paratogosa, is really the same thing as kalyana mitta, the idea of good friends. So good friends, good companions, and good associates are the whole of the spiritual life. And this is one of those remarkable sayings that you find in the suttas, and this is where many of you will know about this, because it is one of those kind of really interesting things that seems so, it seems almost wrong when you read it, but you know that when the Buddha says something, it is probably not wrong, there's probably a deep meaning to it. Where Venerable Ananda goes to the Buddha and says, Venerable Sir, the spiritual friendship is so important that surely it must be 50% of the spiritual life. Yeah? And when you hear that, you think, surely Venerable Ananda is exaggerating. How can spiritual friendship be 50%? Surely there are many other things that matter just as much. Yeah, morality, kindness, compassion, all of these things. How can spiritual friendship be 50% of the spiritual life? And then comes the surprise that the Buddha says, no, it's not 50%, it's 100%. It's like, wow. And I remember reading this the first time, I thought, the Buddha is surely exaggerating, yeah? This is like a figure of speech, it's like approximately, yeah? It's just to kind of make real impact. But the more you read the word of the Buddha, you realize the Buddha doesn't really exaggerate, yeah? He doesn't, what he does usually when he says things like that, it actually that's what he means, unless it is a specific simile. Here is not a simile, it's just a straightforward statement. So he must mean that. Yeah, and now you know why. You know why, because there is only two ways of finding right view. And the first one is the Kalyanamitta. Yeah, this is why the word of the Buddha matters so much. Without that word of the Buddha, you don't even get started. There's nowhere to begin because you are trapped in the cycle of delusion, where avidya, ignorance, gives rise to more avidya in the self-perpetuating circle. And you need something to break that circle. Yeah, and that is the idea of Kalyanamitta. And that is why this matters so enormously. Yeah. So without this, we are like, you know, ships, you know, drifting on the ocean without a steering wheel, without any engine, just being carried around by the conditions around us. The wind making us move in one direction, the currents making us move in another direction, and the sum total of these conditions working on us make us move either to the north, to the south, away from Nibbana, towards Nibbana. We don't really know what's going on, yeah, because we're lacking that understanding of a reality. So we're just kind of in the dark about things. So to even get started, to get that spark of interest in the spiritual path, you need something outside of you that points you in the right direction. And that is the idea of the Kalyanamitta. And this is why it is said by the Buddha to be 100% of the spiritual life. It's kind of, it's very interesting, and it has very important ramifications, right? Once you get this, you understand the importance of the suttas, why you should study the word of the Buddha, why it is worthwhile really reflecting on these things, the importance of listening to Aryas, the noble people in the world. Unfortunately, it's very hard to know who those noble people are, so that's why we tend to come back to the suttas again as the foundation on which everything else is based. You come back to the suttas. When you read the word of the Buddha, it's like you feel like you have this treasure in your hands. This is the right view. This is your chance to kind of begin, to strengthen that beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path. Coming back to this again and again and again. If you understand the importance of right view being as it does standing at the beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path, and that the stronger the right view is, the stronger your ability is to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. You want to strengthen that right view. You want to purify it. You want to build it up. Yeah, and then the whole path arises out of that. So come back to the suttas. Make that right view stronger. See the world as it actually is. Yeah, again and again and again. And as you do that, everything else happens as a consequence. So all you have to do is hang out with the Buddha. Yeah, and that's such a nice idea, hanging out with the Buddha. What does that mean? Well, it means reading the suttas. When you read the suttas, you hang out with the Buddha. And it's just so interesting. One of the things that I always say to people when I do these meditation retreats is that I always remind them that when the Buddha was teaching the Dhamma, even though this is 2,500 years ago, even though it is in a very different culture, the Indian culture at that time, when the Buddha gave these teachings, he knew that this teaching was going to last for a long time into the future. He was talking about setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. He knew that this was going to roll out into the world, roll from century to century, millennium to millennium, from culture, one culture to another culture. He obviously knew that at the very beginning. And because he knew that, he phrased the Dhamma in such a way that when you read it now, you think, wow, this speaks to me. Yeah, it's kind of universal truths. You know that many of these things are right straight away. It doesn't matter that the cultural gap is so enormous. It doesn't matter that the temporal gap is so large. Because these are things that speak directly to us as human beings. And you recognize it across all of those barriers of culture and time. So it's so powerful, yeah? So when you read the suttas, remember that the Buddha, in a sense, he had us in mind, yeah? Maybe you feel that you're not a disciple of the Buddha, but you are. You are just as much a disciple of the Buddha as the people sitting there right in front of him. Because he wasn't just speaking to those people in front of him, he was speaking to everyone. Anyone who is a human being, he had in mind at that time. So remember that when you're reading the suttas, you are sitting there, yeah, almost like a disciple. You are not really any different from the disciples who were present at the time. He's speaking to you. Remember that, he's speaking to you when you read these things. Good friendship, good companions, good associates are the whole of the spiritual life. So we should translate the suttas in such a way that it is a natural language. Yeah? You really have the feeling that you're sitting in the presence of the Buddha. If the language is too elevated, if the language is too artificial, if it is too intellectual, too complex, it takes away that immediate feeling of being in the presence of someone. There should be a simple thing. Yeah. Then it is right. And these, if you think in this way, this is when it gives rise to a sense of inspiration. Yeah, it gives a sense of, wow, this is really amazing. I too am a disciple of the Buddha himself. And that's kind of awesome. That's kind of sadhu, 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 awesome, awesome, awesome. Okay, so the Kalyanamitta, so important. And this is how you purify that idea of Kalyanamitta. Yeah? You understand, reflect, as Venerable Mudita was saying this morning, it's not just about reading the suttas, but reflect on them. What do they mean? Yeah, and then gradually it goes into you. It starts to change who you are. You start to really understand what this is about. It is really about the very meaning of life itself. And this is kind of what is so amazing about these teachings. It's not just some kind of, a bit of spiritual comfort in your life. No, this is it. This is the meaning of life. This is what it's all about. That is why it is so extraordinarily powerful. And if we were able to get that message out there, that this really is the meaning of life, I think the whole world would start to listen. Everyone who is serious, I think everybody deep down is looking for the meaning of life. So there is a lot of potential there. A monk or nun with good friends, companions, and associates can expect to develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path, starting with right view. That is how right view gets going.
Yeah, I like that idea. You get it somewhere. You get it from the Buddha, and then it goes on with the Sangha and other good friends as well. So it's we have to have that as 100% to start it there. So it's the inspiration is such an important thing.
Yeah, and it's getting this straight, getting what this actually is, because you wander around in the darkness unless you have someone who shows you what's going on. So, and Kalyanamittas, yes, it is the Buddha, it is also your spiritual friends, anyone who supports you in your practice in the right way is a kind of Kalyanamitta. But of course, the Buddha is the primary Kalyanamitta. Okay, let's move on. Okay, this is just a nice little sutta I thought I would show it. I'm not going to comment too much. There's one person who arises in the world for the ruin, harm, and suffering of many people. What do you think? Mara. Is Mara a person though? Well, you probably you're right. Yeah, so it could be Mara. Actually, it's not though. This is the interesting thing. It's not Mara. It's someone else. What was that?
Donald Trump rises in the world.
Donald Trump.
Probably right as well.
Well,
poor Donald.
Okay.
There have been many people like that.
Yeah.
Whether it's Trump or Hitler or...
Yeah. Hitler. You think that's Hitler? That's good. Yeah.
I think he did a lot of those things, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is more a general thing, you see. It's not a specific person. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so now I've kind of whetted your appetite. Are you excited now? Who is this person? So this is how you kind of make a bit of suspense that makes everything much more interesting. So let's see what this is. Da 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 da. Ding. One who has wrong view. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. If it is one with wrong view, with incorrect perspective. Yeah. But there's more to it. This is only the first line. Yeah. But the one with wrong view is the one, and especially if the following is true. This is not just someone who is wrong view, but someone who is influential who has wrong view, someone who is a leader, yeah? He draws many people away from the good Dhamma and establishes them in the Bad Dhamma. So this is a teacher, someone who is famous, someone who has many disciples, but who is mistaken in their view. They are the ones who are really problematic because they draw people away from the Dhamma. Yeah? That's very fascinating, and I think this is it's a great lesson to be remembered. So often we tend to believe people who have a certain charisma or have a certain following in the world. We say, oh, this teacher is really kind of wise. Why? Well, because everyone else says he or she is wiser. Maybe that's not such a good idea. True. Yeah, maybe that's not enough. Just because other people say so, does that mean that we should just take on board that view just like that? You have to be very careful with that, because the majority of people in the world are basically blind. Yeah, the majority of people in the world are not Aryas. And just because a large number of people say something is true, it doesn't mean that is the case. So always stand on your own two feet. Always ask yourself, don't just go with something because the majority says it's true. Look for yourself. Read the suttas for yourself. Try to understand what is going on. And then decide whether the person is right or not. And there's a lot of wrong view in Buddhism. There's a lot of Buddhist leaders around the world, monastic or otherwise, who have wrong view. As far as I can tell anyway. Yeah. And so a lot of people are getting sidetracked, getting taken away from the real path. So make sure you investigate. Don't just follow what other people say. Sometimes you hear things like, oh yeah, no, you know, this person is an arahant, so if you say something bad about them, you're going to go to hell. So I say only good things about this person. But that's a crazy way of thinking. Yeah, because what that means is that they have a reputation for being an arahant, but actually maybe they have wrong view. And then that is really bad. You know, then you should really be a bit critical, yeah? And that is where you go wrong. If someone has the characteristics of not being an arahant, then you better take that seriously. Otherwise, you might be in big trouble. So watch for yourself. Don't jump to conclusions, but don't be afraid of seeing things that are actually there. Don't deny reality just because a large number of people say, oh no, don't say anything bad, they're an arahant. Don't think like that, because if you do, you're going to be led astray. This is what this is about. There is one person who arises in the world for the good, welfare, and happiness of many people. Who is that? The one who has right view, correct perspective. He draws many people away from the bad Dhamma and establishes them in the good Dhamma instead. That is like the Buddha. That are the people who are real Aryas in the world.
Sometimes I feel it's quite a daunting task for a teacher, especially when you're starting. It's like there's this fear of leading people astray. But at least, you know, you have to start somewhere. You might get some things wrong, but at least you tried to pull from the suttas. And there's quite a lot of monks who I know who are really afraid to speak anything outside of the suttas.
Yeah.
So they just all the time speak about the suttas and all that. But sometimes it gets a bit dry. Sometimes it doesn't draw the audience. So that's why I think Ajahn Brahm has been such a good teacher, that he knows the suttas, but he's able to put the flesh in them. Yeah. Sometimes it's a bit difficult. I was criticized a few times that I've been sort of following the Ajahn Brahm's way of speaking and try to bring these things sometimes for the real life, that they said, you know, if you speak certain way, you know, you have your perspective, and I can say something else. Well, who's right? This is your perception. What are you speaking from? And sure, I mean, sometimes you just have to do that, but there is that sort of little bit of fear and the backside of, am I leading people astray?
But it's ground. I think if you ground it in the suttas, and as long as it is aligned with the suttas and it's not opposed to it, it's okay. I think one of the main duties as a monastic and as a teacher is to make sure you present the teachings of the Buddha. That is the main kind of main job.
Yeah.
And yes, I fully agree. We shouldn't do it in a dry way. You should do it in a way which brings it alive. That is really important. But drawing in a little bit of personal anecdotes, I think, is great. Marvelous. But, you know, it's always a balance. But I think that you can make these teachings come alive. That is the most wonderful thing you can do of all. And then you are on the right track. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, so that is a little bit about the idea of the Kalyanamitta, how important that is and how that gets you established on the path. So that is where it comes from. So I hope you're satisfied with that. Yeah? Okay. Good. At least one satisfied customer today. So that's marvelous. So. Let's go on to the next one. Yeah. So and now we come to Yoniso Manasikara. I do not see even a single thing because of which the unarisen right view arises, and the arisen right view increases so much as careful attention. Yoniso Manasikara. Yeah. So again, you can see here that the right view being something which gradually increases. Yeah. It's not something which is kind of there right away. And so what gives rise to right view? Well, one thing then is the Kalyanamitta. The other one is Yoniso Manasikara, careful attention. What does it mean? And I don't think careful attention is the ideal translation, perhaps, because careful attention can mean many things. Yeah, you attend carefully. It doesn't necessarily mean that you are wise just because you are careful. I think Bhante Sujato has proper attention there. Maybe a little bit better, but I like the idea of wise attention. You attend wisely, because that really gets to the core of what this is about. So the word is yoniso manasikara. Manasikara is a verb, it's a noun. Manasi is from manas, which means mind. And kara means like work or action, yeah? The action of the mind. And the action of the mind is to move your attention around. Yeah, the mind moves attention around. You see something, you hear something, you think something. Your attention is constantly moving around. That's the mind working, moving the attention around. Yeah, the work of the mind or the action of the mind, manasikara. And then the idea of yoniso. Yoni is like womb, so it's like the source of things. Yeah, so. It's the idea of the attention that goes to the source of things or is related to the source of things somehow. This is the idea of this. So you're looking for the source. You're looking for, in a sense, one way of thinking about it is as causality, understanding how things arise from causes and then moving on from there is a large part of what Yoniso Manasikara is about. So it is very difficult to know what that is just from your mind. Yeah, is this yoniso manasikara I've got now? It's very hard to really know that. So how do we know that we have yoniso manasikara? Interesting, right? How do you know that you have wise attention? How do you know you don't have stupid attention? Is that the opposite of wise attention? Ayoniso manasikara, maybe stupid is a bit of silly attention. We had a monk called Siripanyo. He was sometimes called Siripanyo. Which means like silly, panya means wisdom. Yeah, so silly wisdom, crazy. I don't know what that means. Anyway, I get sidetracked again here. So how do we know that you have yoniso manasikara? How can you know that? Yeah? Okay, yeah, suffering reduces, right? But how quickly can you know that suffering reduces? You mean in the moment? It reduces in the moment or? Yeah. Okay. But like, you know, but okay, but seeing things as they are, that's quite profound. What about more preliminary yoniso manasikara? Let's say that you have the Bible here and you have the Majjhima Nikaya there and you read and think, oh, which one is right? I wonder. The Bible is quite nice. At that point, it's not so much about suffering increasing, it's about deciding which path to walk. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah. So that I think that is true. So things have to align with the reality, yeah? And that's kind of the idea. But the general definition in the suttas of yoniso manasikara is basically very simple. It's a kind of standard definition you find in many places. It is yoniso manasikara, it's wise attention, if the good qualities are arising and the bad qualities are declining. Yeah, so if you, for example, if I think about Venerable Mudita, I can think about him, oh yeah, this mudita, these fins, they are really kind of, you know, they are, oh, I don't know about these fins, they're too tough.
No, I know what you're talking about.
I don't know how to deal with them. I can think like that, and I can kind of get, oh, how am I get my own back, all the bad things that he has done against me. actually has not any bad things against me. Yes, I'm just making that up.
That's the only
samanasikara. Or I can think, wow, how fortunate I am to have such spiritual companions and work together with them. What a marvelous thing that is. So this is the difference. Yeah, it is how you attend in the moment. And one of those leads to a feeling of uplift, of happiness, of joy. The other one leads you down, maybe to ill will. So what is the result of how you attend, yeah, when you attend to somebody? That is always the how you decide whether something is yoni somanasikara or ayoni somanasikara. So watch your own mind. Watch, you know, when you look at somebody or you think about somebody, how do you feel? What is the outcome of that looking at that person in that particular way? And you will start to understand yoni somanasikara in your own life. What does it mean to attend wisely? What does it mean to attend unwisely? And usually it's very simple things. Yeah, these things sound like very fancy words. It sounds like very fancy philosophy, but actually it's very, very simple. You attend to someone looking for the faults, ill will arises. Okay, maybe I shouldn't look at the faults. You attend to something looking for the good sides in the person. Wow, these are all Buddhist people. These are all trying to do the right thing, living in a good way. What a marvelous thing that is. And then good feeling arises inside you. Instead, it's very simple things like that. This is what it means, yoni somanasikara. Or you look at the world outside, you think, wow, this world is so beautiful. Oh, I love the world. The world is marvelous. And then comes COVID-19, and you think, well, maybe I was wrong about the world. Maybe it's not as good as climate change comes and starts destroying things, or whatever else is, or earthquakes destroy everything. And you start to realize, maybe that was a wrong way of thinking about the world. Maybe the world is neither really beautiful nor ugly, but it's certainly problematic and impermanent. And if I hold on too much, I'm going to suffer. Yeah, that simple things like that. That is what yoni somanasikara is. Of course, it goes deeper and deeper and deeper, and eventually it comes all the way to the profound aspects of yoni somanasikara, which is when you turn your mind to the impermanence of all conditioned things and non-self and all of that. But that too is actually quite simple. It's always dangerous with the Buddhist path. Everything sounds so fancy, and you know, you can talk about insight, and it sounds so utterly complicated. But all of these things are so simple when it comes to the mind. It's just when we try to express these things verbally that they often become so complicated and convoluted, etc. So when does such a view as this arise? Here we come into the more profound aspect of yoni somanasikara. When does a view such as this arise? That which is the self is the world. Having passed away, that I shall be. What? Having passed away, that I shall be. Permanent, stable, eternal, not subject to change. Yeah, this is kind of the idea of permanence. Yeah, this is where we're talking about the deeper ideas of wrong view. The idea that you're going to be permanent after you die. Yay, I'm going to live forever. Yay, always happy, no problems. I'm going to be join forces with Brahma. I just exist forever and ever after. Hooray. So that is, why do people have that view? Yeah, and that comes from ayoniso manasikara, unwise attention. And what kind of unwise attention? The grasping of form, grasping of feeling, grasping of perception, grasping of the will, and grasping of consciousness. Yes, whenever the mind moves towards grasping anything in your experience, that is when these things happen. And this is the deep, profound aspect of ayoniso manasikara. When we grasp the world, we grasp the aspects of the personal existence, the aspects of personality, if you like. So eventually all of this is undone by the practice of the path.
There's a little bit of
feedback
coming through. This is undone by the practice of the path, and eventually you see that these things are not really worthwhile grasping, and that is then the yoni somanasikara, which undermines that grasping. And then eventually you become a stream enter. You get the final right view. So yoni somanasikara and right view in this way go hand in hand. Yeah, you keep on using yoni somanasikara, refining it gradually, using it to overcome your defilements. Eventually, using it in this way to get the final right view. So the view becoming gradually purified as you use Yono Samana Sikara, and then you bring in the Buddha's teachings to help you attend wisely. That is what the Buddha's teachings do. When you read them, you understand how the Buddha talks about practicing the path. You start to attend wisely because you follow what the Buddha says. So listening to the word of the Buddha, the voice of another, leads to Yono Samana Sikara, then leads to right view. And all of this rolls on, gradually, gradually purifying itself. Shall we take a small short
break? Yeah, we've been going for quite a while.
Let's have a short break, just a short meditation break. Okay. So let us continue. Are there any questions, comments, or anything else?
So attention is like you attend on something like the breath, and yoniso or ayoniso means how you do it, right? Whether it's wise way or unwise way.
Yeah.
So when somebody's meditating and watching the breath, you can watch the breath. It's how you watch the breath makes a world of a difference whether you progress or not.
Mm.
Just sitting down and watching the breath won't get you enlightened if you don't do it in the right way.
Yeah.
Can you explain the right way to watch the breath and the wrong way to watch the breath?
Yeah. Okay. If you are able to watch the breath at all, it is already quite good because it means that you are not so distracted. So it's already a good sign, the fact that you are able to stay with the breath, yeah? That's already quite a good sign because most people find it very hard to stay with the breath. The breath tends to disappear. So already you're doing a lot right just by being able to stay with the breath. But the main thing is not to hold on to the breath too much, to be relaxed with it. That is, I think, one of the main things. And if you find that it is uncomfortable to watch the breath in any way, you're not really at ease with it, really relaxed with it, usually it's a sign that you're holding on too much to it. And that, I think, is the main problem with people. But it should be a very natural process, very easy process. Like you're sitting down, you're watching something beautiful, something you really enjoy watching, like a nice sunset or a nice movie or whatever it is that you really enjoy watching. You just do not have to force yourself to watch it. You're just sitting back and just having a good time. The breath should be like that. But a lot of time people don't prepare the mind enough. Because they don't prepare the mind enough, it means that they are not really ready, and the only way they're going to be able to watch the breath is by grasping it, holding it. It becomes very uncomfortable and very painful to do. So that's why you have to do it very slowly and gradually and make sure you prepare yourself properly before you do it.
Lead you to wisdom?
How can watching the breath lead you to wisdom? Well, it is in many ways, but just by becoming more peaceful, yeah? That is already, you have more wisdom. If you become peaceful, you have more wisdom already, because that is a state where you see that actually this is really nice, this is peaceful. You abandon the worldly pleasures because this is a much more delightful thing. The deeper that meditation is, the more right view you will have in that way, yeah? That is the beginning. And then beyond that, you take the breath meditation to very profound levels, and you look back on the process, you see all these things ceasing and disappearing during the process, and you understand that these things are impermanent, non-self, etc., because they have ceased. And then you gain wisdom based on reflecting on the Viraga Nupassana, Nirodha Nupassana, Nitya Nupassana, Patanissaka Nupassana, which are the Pali words for the four last stages of the mindfulness of breathing in the Anapanasati Sutta. So most of it happens after you come out of the meditation and you reflect on the process. Something like that, yeah.
Jan, you know the one about the vipalasas? Is sanya, the perception, distorted mind and distorted view, those are synonymous, is that correct?
Are they synonymous? They go hand in hand, but they're not really synonymous.
But they're all referring to those four things, right? Those four points.
Yeah. Yes, correct. That's yes.
Right.
So you see.
So, in that sense, could we say that that's a sutta reference that shows that right view is having, you know, seeing impermanence as impermanence and not the other way around? That would be one sutta reference that shows, because even though it doesn't say wrong view, it doesn't say Michha Aditi, it does say distorted view. Sure. And that's basically the same, yeah? And even this one, the one that, well, you can't see the top part, but this idea of that being, what does it say, arising of wrong view? Yeah, when does such a view as the sort of the sense of there being an eternal self, and that's due to grasping to the form or whatever, and so this is also kind of pointing to right view as including a view of non-self.
Permanence. Yeah, I think it is fair. I think if you looked at the suttas carefully, you probably find lots of evidence for that. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. And the other thing was when you were talking about this, I can't even read my handwriting. Okay, does the Sotapanna have pure perception all the time or only after jhanas? Like, they always have right view, but does that necessarily mean they're going to perceive with the right view all the time?
Yeah. We have to get there first, I guess. I mean, that's the thing I asked to talk to Ajahn Brahm about it this morning. And what he was saying is that it's the... I'm not good remembering these details too much, but he said that that's the thing about this. Sometimes, like, that's how you translate the citta, the mind there, is so that your thoughts are not purified yet. So your view is sort of purified in the sense that you see everything as a non-eternal. It's not self. You don't see self anywhere because you see it's changing and you see your previous lives and all that. But the your thoughts are not purified yet. But so you look confused. So,
well, I guess
can you refer?
That's thoughts, but what about their perception?
Is your perception purified? Yeah.
Perceptions are even more basic than thoughts. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how you think about, how you perceive things, you don't have to think to perceive. It's pre-verbal.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have perceptions, even within a jhana state, you have perceptions, or even prior, even in a very peaceful mind, there are perceptions there that can be wrong, can be wrong or right. So these are just almost like different levels of mind, coarseness of the mental process. Perceptions are the most basic. From those perceptions, you start to think. So you perceive someone as an enemy, it might be pre-verbal, and you think about them in a negative way. Yeah? And then after a while, the view gets established, well, they really are an enemy, yeah? The more you think like that. Yeah? So it is like a sequence, the building up on each other. Yeah? The view is the most developed of those three things. Yeah? So the view is an idea about something, which is built up of many thoughts and many perceptions usually. Yeah? You have a view of, you know, of politics or whatever it is, and it's built up of all of these things. Yeah? And because it is built, and so the view is the first thing that you then see through by seeing. When you see reality, the view can no longer be sustained. So if you ask a stream mentor about, is there a self, they will always say no. Mm. But sometimes they will still perceive a self because of old habits of the mind.
Mm.
Or think about it in terms of self. But if you stop them and say, well, listen, you know, is there a self, they will always say no.
Okay.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. So that would be when they lose mindfulness, they might...
Do they lose mindfulness?
Lose sight of right view, and then they would perceive in terms of a self.
Well, they lose mindfulness of that particular issue.
Yeah.
Right, at that sort of in that particular moment.
Yeah.
Because even anagami has sense of self, so the same thing must be happening, right? That they might temporarily lose mindfulness and they lose their contact with right view in that,
so that
millisecond or whatever it is that they still have sense of self. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So then the converse, like if you don't have right view, would you still have pure perception after jhana? Like, you know how you have stories of mystics from other religions having things that sound very much like jhana experiences. So when they come out of it, they have no hindrances. So they would be perceiving without hindrances.
Yeah.
But with that right view, would that be considered pure perception or whatever?
Yeah, because the right view of stream entry is that you see all sankharas as anicca and dukkha. All sankharas, right? But when you come out of a jhana state, you will focus on certain sankharas, not all sankharas. Mm. So you will see whatever you're focusing on, that you will see in the right way, as anicca, dukkha, anatta. But when you universalize that to include all sankharas, that is what stream entry is. You see the difference? So you may, and whatever you focus on in the moment, okay, these glasses, they are anicca. They're not dukkha, though. I don't know. How can they be dukkha? I can see clearly. But they are dukkha, ultimately. Yeah, so these, I understand these particular sankharas as afflicted by the three conditions when I come out of jhana. Yeah, but I never see, and I don't see all sankharas as affected by that. That's what the stream mantra does. Everything is affected by those three sankharas. It takes a while for you to make the
breakthrough
from the leap from seeing individual things to universalizing that to include everything. All things.
Right. I mean, even before getting to the point of being able to universalize it, would they be able to interpret their experience as being something like non-self, even if it's like one jhana experience only or something? Would they, you know, that without having that prior right view, it just might be a cool experience, or it might be interpreted in a self kind of way, the self.
That comes afterwards. That comes.
Right.
Once that comes, like when the. That strength of the jhana it disappears. You start, the world starts sucking you in. But after that, when you're doing that initial, when you look through, when you get out of the jhana, anywhere you look, you see that even that jhana wasn't, it doesn't belong to me. It wasn't me. It's not happiness, because you can see that, oh, it disappeared. You see the suffering aspect of it. So you have the right view, the view there.
Okay. Well, I just remember Ajahn Brahm talking about how some Christian mystics might interpret a jhana experience as being union with God.
Yeah.
And so then it would have that feeling of bliss, or that sort of sense of purity of the mind, but it would be interpreted from that lens. So then it wouldn't, I mean, I don't know, I'm assuming your sense of pure perception, your use of that term means pure perception, mean perceiving according to, you know, anicca is anicca, anatta is anatta, that kind of thing, right?
Well, they're not looking for, you know, they are not trying to universalize. Whatever they're looking at, they will see right, but they're not trying to look at, you know, the all conditioned phenomena. They have a pre-existing idea of a God, and that is kind of excluded from what they're looking at, so they kind of assume things.
Okay, so then by pure perception, you just mean seeing without hindrances, that's your definition?
Yeah.
Okay. And I guess this kind of relates to, sorry, I'm asking so many questions, but they're sort of related. Yonisomanasikara and Paratagosa being two conditions, are those like two both required, or is it possible to have just Yonisomanasikara without having heard the words from another? For instance, if you were the Buddha, you were a Pacheka Buddha, and that would be enough, or would it be like, oh, but they had Paratagosa in previous lives and heard the Buddhas in previous lives, and that's how it's always kind of there. Do you need them both to be there?
Yeah, it looks to me like you can become a Buddha just by Yonisomanasikara. That's what it looks like to me personally. Yeah.
So but you don't feel like they're having heard the Buddha's teachings in previous lives matters, or
I don't think. Well, it doesn't. That certainly not doesn't say that in the sutta. Suttas anyway. We have to hear. You know, a Buddha has to hear the word of a previous Buddha. Yeah. It's problematic, because if a lot of time passes by, that means that you might not be able to give rise to Buddhism again. Yeah. If a stream mantra only exists for seven lifetimes at the most, and those seven lifetimes, how much time would they add up to? Maybe at the maximum, it will be the limited time how long they can exist for, yeah? Say an eon or something like that. At the very most, probably much less, but at the very most. Now, if the previous Buddha was more than an eon ago, I guess it depends how far back that memory was from. Let's say you remember your past lives, etc. Yeah. Anyway, it seems to me that you can very easily get a break in Buddhas, if that is the case. If there's a long distance between the previous Buddha, it would be a long, long way back. Yeah. Am I making any sense? The math is very uncertain. Let's move on, Venerable, because it's getting really late. So if you wish, you can more than welcome to come up afterwards. We can discuss it more afterwards if you don't. That's okay, yeah. So, okay. So this is, now we're coming to the third session. This is the third session supposed to start.
Great, we have 45 minutes.
Yeah. So we're actually getting a bit late. Should we, what shall we do? I'm not sure what to do now. Starting with our intention now, is that a bit too late? It's getting too late. I think it's getting too late. We only have 15 minutes left.
Oh, we're stopping at 5:30. It's not, also, not 6 o'clock.
Always 5:30. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't think it's any point in carrying on much more. Would you agree?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Because otherwise we're going to kind of go too far. So, does anyone else have any comments? Anything you want? Ananda, yeah, please. Yeah. And then Thomas afterwards.
Thank you, Ajahn. It's a sort of continuation of what Venerable Munisara was asking.
Yeah.
Would you say Yoniso Manasikara is at various degrees? Because true Yoniso Manasikara would come only, as you were explaining, that after jhana, or free from those four distortions, free from those four vipallasas, that is seeing anicca as anicca, seeing dukkha as dukkha, seeing anatta as anatta, and seeing asubha as asubha.
Yeah.
Is that the...
Absolutely. This is the thing. And this idea is that you can have a degree of yoniso manasikara at the very beginning, even though the defilements are there. But that would be a very preliminary kind of yoniso manasikara. So you may hear the Buddha's teaching, and you may think, wow, this is really cool stuff. Yeah, you know, it's a modern way of thinking about it. It doesn't say that in the suttas, but this is really great. Yeah, and then you get attracted to the suttas. You still have hindrances in the mind, but you have enough to lean you in the right direction. And that is why it says whenever it leads to less defilements and more good qualities, then it is called yoniso manasikara. So even if you just think, oh, maybe I should be a bit more kind, yeah? That already is in the right, leaning in the right direction. You're heading in the right way. It is a kind of yoniso manasikara, but it's a very preliminary one. The real yoniso manasikara, as you say, happen when all the hindrances are gone. Because the hindrances are, in a sense, they are like vested interests in the world. Yeah, the world means something to you. You are attached to it. And because that of attachment and holding on and having that vested interest, it is impossible to see things clearly. Yeah? Because there is because you want something in that world. This is mine, this is me. You don't want to give it up, so you cannot see things clearly. So you have to leave that aside first. When the vested interest is gone, then it is possible to see things in the right way. So that is the real yoniso manasikara, as you say. Yeah?
So probably that's why Buddha used the word yoni, because that's the origin or the birth from the womb, as you said. So that is the original truth which we see after the all the vipallasas have been cleared. Is that the word yoni?
Yeah.
Yoni.
Yeah.
You go back to the real truth, real original truth.
Back to the original truth, yeah, okay, yeah.
The birth?
I'm not sure if
it's the word... speculating that that was the reason why he used the word, choose the word yoniso.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it is ever used quite in that way in the suttas, but it's usually called Yatabuddha Nanadasana, something like that, but okay, yeah.
So if you should be so lucky to fluga jhana, how long time do you have with pure awareness to penetrate? A couple of seconds, a couple of minutes, a couple of hours until you delude it again?
What does the sutta say about it? It depends on the degree.
It depends on many things. On what you do afterwards, and if you kind of just chill and you sit on your room and you don't do anything, it's going to last for a long time. But if you kind of put yourself, you go out and meet nasty people and do all kind of stuff, it may last a lot shorter. So it really depends on what you do afterwards. But it can, usually it will last for hours, maybe days sometimes, depending on how powerful the experience is. So
then there should actually be a fair chance of actually breaking through Sadhama, like, after the first jhana, if you use it wisely.
Yep. That's the purpose of the jhanas. You can, like you said, you can have the breakthrough. You can actually see the reality as it is.
Stream entry.
It doesn't mean you're going to break through the stream entry straight away. It's too difficult. It's you to straighten your view that into all of those things. You see the reality at the moment where you look your mind into. Ajahn Brahmali was explaining certain aspects of it, but not everything all the time. It will fade away. These habits you have now are going to take over.
And is first jhana strong enough for that?
Sorry?
First jhana, is that enough? Fourth jhana, or what?
Yeah, it seems to be the first one at least has to be enough.
And then the best thing to contemplate is so you don't waste any time. It's kind of the three characteristics, the Four Noble Truths, and
exactly right. You know it already, so don't worry about it. They will come automatically. You don't have to write them down in front of you every time you meditate. Have a like piece of paper in front of you. Remember to contemplate. You know the Anicca Dukkhanas and all those.
That's really smart. That's really
That's how you should have. Like eightfold path, every sequence, you know them. Yeah. The thing is, like, they come automatically. It's sort of like you look at something and you remember the teachings and you say, oh, even that's impermanent. And you see things, you know, coming up and they're disappearing. So you see the coming and disappearing, and you see that there's no self there, and there was like that was happiness. You see those characteristics, and because you heard the teachings. Yeah.
The thing is that when you get to that stage, you have abandoned almost everything already. Most of the world is not in those jhanas. Most of the world is in the five senses. You only have a tiny little bit left, and that is the happiness and peace of the first jhana. Mm. Everything else, you already know it's impermanent because you have let it go. It's gone, completely gone from your consciousness. So you already, with the jhanas, you already have a very profound insight into the nature of reality. All you have left is a jhana experience. So what you really do, and this is what you see in the suttas, is you contemplate that jhana experience itself as impermanent, non-self, and dukkha. And if you can see that, then everything will go. That's kind of how it's often explained in the suttas.
And that's, I think, it's a good point, as Pramali was saying, that it's even this is gradual. Even to get to the jhanas is gradual path. It won't be just you sit down one day and you haven't done any meditation, you get there. It's gradual, you slowly start realizing this is happiness, the self is disappearing, there is calmness there, and it becomes nicer and nicer to hang out there, and you keep adding into that. So slowly you're stepping towards that. Yeah. So like you said, the self is not there, the body disappears and the mind starts disappearing and it gets more and more happiness, but then the happiness takes over. Yeah.
Okay, anything else? Yeah, okay.
I'm just starting to wake up after the fifth cup of coffee you made.
You're waking up now, are you?
Okay. This was the best coffee.
Welcome.
Nice cup of coffee.
Was it? Okay,
yeah,
good.
Compliment.
Okay, please.
You touched on the five aggregates, the five khandhas.
Yeah.
So the Noble Fourfold Path talks about suffering, and I was wondering whether you could expand on the five aggregates. Because we, lay people especially, because of the sensuality, when we have contact with good food or good movie or whatever, we get very excited.
Yeah.
So how do you see that as being not yourself?
Monks do get very excited when they see food. Yeah. Wow.
Especially when you're hungry.
Especially when you're hungry.
You know, I think therefore I am. I mean, all our culture, Western culture, is all based on I at the forefront. So the five khandhas, it's very hard to say, think of non-self with feeling, the contact, the perceptions.
So you are. So you're asking how? So sorry, you five khandhas.
How do you see that? Manasikara. How do you wisely attend to those things when you think it's you?
Okay. So first of all, the five khandhas, they may sound like very mysterious things. The five aspects of personality is how I would like to translate it. Sometimes called the five aggregates. But what they really are is a question we get all the time. Yeah, what are the five khandhas? And I say, oh, it's easy. Yeah, it's form, feeling, perception, will, and consciousness. And then they say, but what are they? Yeah, and it's a fair question because it's not enough really just to enumerate them like that. It still doesn't relate to reality in a sense. What they are, the five khandhas, is what you have now. What is your experience now? That's the five khandhas, yeah? Right now you experience the five khandhas. Form, yeah, okay. You see things. Feelings, you feel something. Maybe you enjoy, maybe you don't. I don't know what you feel. You have a perception about something, yeah? You perceive. In other words, that's people. Nicholas, yeah? Nicholas perception. The Nicholas perception. I call it Nicholas Nicolatos. Because he used to offer chocolate at the monastery. So we got the nickname Nicolatos after that. So that's a kind of a term of endearment in the monastery for Nicholas. So that's a perception. Yeah? Nicolatos is a mixture of Nicholas and chocolate perceived, added into one kind of perception. Yeah? Then there is the will. And the will is just the agency inside of you. Yeah? Every time you make a choice, it's the agency, the activity. And then consciousness is the... all of these things you have right now. Yeah, what is your agency? What are you turning your attention towards? Maybe you're listening to what I say. Maybe you're fantasizing about something. I don't know which. Yeah, we cannot listen all the time, so it's okay to admit that sometimes you are drifting a bit. So that's the agency, yeah? Where are you attending to? That's the will. So all of these aspects of existence and the consciousness, just the ability to be aware, the ability to know what's going on, consciousness, they are there right now. It's just experience. That's all it is. It is just a particular way of dividing up experience into... Not, I wouldn't say it's constituents, because it's artificial division. It's just a way of dividing up artificially our experience. Our experience really is a solid whole, a complete whole. Yeah, WHOLD, whole in that sense. It's a complete thing. And then it is an artificial way of dividing it up so that you can investigate it in a wise way. The purpose of that kind of division is to be able to investigate it. And that means in terms of impermanence, non-self, and suffering that you're talking about. So how do we do that? And the way to do that is you find in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta. Yeah, the deeper your meditation is, the more things will have faded away, will have ceased in your meditation. Body, when you go very, very deep, the body fades away, the five senses fade away, the hindrances fade away. Yeah. So a lot of things kind of gradually fade away. And what is it that fades away? Actually, it is the five khandhas that fade away. Yeah, body fading away means the form khandha is being reduced. Certain feelings disappear. You cannot feel any negative feelings anymore, any dukkha vedana. All you have is joy. Yeah. So you know dukkha vedana has come to an end. Certain perceptions are gone. When you go into a very deep samadhi, all the senses are gone. A large part of your perceptual world has disappeared. The will is dying down, yeah? The will is disappearing. Yeah? You can see the impermanence of the will, you see the fading away of these things, and eventually you see their cessation. And when you see that, you understand their impermanence, because it's fading away and ceasing. Permanence is bleeding obvious. You understand their non-self, because you can let them go completely. They're no longer there. They have got nothing to do with those. There must be non-self. And you feel much more happy when they're gone. There must be dukkha. You understand them in terms of the three characteristics. Yeah. So the deeper your meditation is, the deeper your samatha is, the deeper your samadhi is, the greater is your ability to have an insight afterwards. Because that depth of peace means more things have ceased, more things have come to an end. That gives you the data, if you like, to enable you to have insight into these things. Yeah. So I'm not sure, are we still on topic, at right view, I guess? I guess this is about right view, yeah. So I just...
Yeah, that was quite technical.
Was it?
Maybe. I think sometimes we make it too technical with these things, and your question was quite a technical one, but the thing is, Ajahn Pramali was talking about at the end, is the peace and all of those things. How do you see the movies and how you see the food and all that? Is it leading towards the peace, what he was alluding to, or is it leading you away from the peace? Are you distracting yourself all the time, wisely or unwisely? Once in a while, maybe you need that distraction, but don't go... let's say eating, people eat because they're feeling sad or something. It's not leading you towards the peace. You don't have the wise attention. Then why are you eating then? Why? Trying to make it practical. I mean, okay, sure, we have these words and they're sort of artificial divisions, a lot of them, but we have to give names to certain things in order to them to exist. All of these things, what, you know, the yoni somanasikara, you know, wise attention, all the what you're attending to, you divide
things into many multiple parts, constituents?
Something like that.
Yeah. They are still artificial things, but are they useful for your life? Are they actually making a difference in that day-to-day life? Are you attending things wisely in a sense that the wise meaning kindness? If you just change those words, change them with the, they mean something to you. Am I being kind towards myself when I'm going into this direction? So yeah, I'm not very technically minded. I've said it many times, but these things sometimes they just seem to almost be like a hindrance sometimes because you're trying to get some use them in real life. Real life, yeah.
Okay. Anything else, Thomas?
I just couldn't get the numbers really to add up because I said, oh, the spiritual friends 100%, and then nothing was as important factor as the wise attention, so that's more than 100%.
With the 110%.
But wise attention comes from the spiritual friendship, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Ajahn Sucitto, he suggests that the Buddha's reply to Nanda might be a play on word. He said, no, Nanda, friendship of the spiritual is the whole of the holy life.
Friendship of the spiritual.
Friendship. Rather than spiritual friends.
Oh, okay, I see, yeah.
But I don't know Pali that well, so maybe.
Yeah. Kalanamitta means spiritual friends, not friendship with the spiritual. I think that is actually what the Buddha meant. Because without that, unless you are become a Buddha or a Pacheka Buddha, which is not really, you know, what this path is about, then that's what it means. You need that kind of voice of another person. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Okay. Nice to see you all again. So if you are ready for more punishment, we'll see you in a week. And so let's call it a day. Let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha before we go.